The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Author Events Series. I'm Tracy Matisak, and I'll be assisting with our audience Q&A portion of the program tonight. We are honored to have with us Professor James Oakes, one of the leading historians of 19th century America, as our speaker tonight. Dr. Oakes, as you may know, has an international reputation for groundbreaking scholarship, specifically on the history of the United States from the Revolution to the Civil War. His early work focused on the South, examining slavery as an economic and social system that shaped Southern life. His pioneering books include Slavery and Freedom, an Interpretation of the Old South, and Freedom National, The Destruction of Slavery in the United States, 1861 to 1865. He has twice been the recipient of the Gilder Lehrman Lincoln Prize, which is an annual award for the finest scholarly work in English on Abraham Lincoln of the Civil War era. His newest book, which of course we will be discussing tonight, is The Crooked Path to Abolition, Abraham Lincoln and the Anti-Slavery Constitution, which was released just last month. Professor Oakes is an alumnus of Baruch College and holds master's and PhD degrees from University of California, Berkeley. He has been on the faculty of the Graduate Center of the City University of New York since 1987 and is the holder of the Graduate School Humanities Chair since 1998. And prior to that, he taught at Princeton and Northwestern universities. Professor Oakes will be in conversation tonight with Professor Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University, where he has specialized in the Civil War and Reconstruction. I should also mention that he has specialized in slavery and, of course, 19th century America as a whole. He's also been the curator of several museum exhibitions, including the prize-winning A House Divided, America in the Age of Lincoln at the Chicago Historical Society. Dr. Foner has written numerous books, including The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, which won the Pulitzer, Bancroft, and Lincoln Prizes in 2011. So, of course, we invite you to add your questions for Professor Oakes or perhaps Professor Foner, for that matter, as well, by clicking on the Q&A icon that you should find at the bottom of your screen there. You can type your question into that space, and, of course, we will get through as many of those as we can in the time that we have. So, with all of that said, professors, take it away.
Well, thank you, Tracy, and thanks to the library for hosting this event. And I want to say first, I'm very happy to be here to engage in conversation with my good friend and colleague, Professor James Oakes. And I just want to say at the very beginning that this new book of his is really well worth reading, and I urge you to go out to your local bookstore and find a copy. It's not easy when writing about Lincoln to say something original. I'm not going to go into the fact that there are thousands of books already on Lincoln. But I also want to point out that Jim Oakes writes with really praiseworthy clarity. He's dealing with some complex issues here of constitutional interpretation, but it's always clear and very understandable all the way through. Having said that, I want to maybe begin the conversation, Jim, by asking you, I guess this is sort of the inevitable first question. Why were you inspired to write yet another book about Lincoln? There are thousands of them out there, as you know. Right. Or maybe I can refine that question a little to say, what does your focus on the Constitution and Lincoln's understanding of the Constitution add? What's the value added of that mode of analysis to what we already know about Abraham Lincoln?
Wow, that's a big question. I never thought I'd be writing another book about Lincoln. I sort of share the general impression of a lot of us in the field that we've overdosed on Abraham Lincoln. I kind of backed into this because I was really interested in I have been interested for some time in the question of what it takes to build a successful progressive coalition in American politics, specifically focusing on this question of how do you get an anti-slavery coalition that succeeds in ways that few progressive coalitions in American history have succeeded. And with each iteration of that question, as I've examined it since I started writing a long time ago on the relationship between Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, I kept backing further and further into the degree to which Lincoln's constitutional views represented a much larger aspect of that political coalition, that anti-slavery politics, than I had originally realized, that I think most historians realize. Lincoln is often referred to as a constitutional conservative. And there's an older tradition of historiography that denounces Lincoln for his violations, his trampling on the Constitution and the like. And I thought neither of those quite gets at what the Constitution meant to abolitionists and to anti-slavery politicians and to politics, anti-slavery politics in general in the middle of the 19th century. And I ended up putting the two together. I was interested in emancipation and how the Civil War managed to lead to the abolition of slavery in the United States. And I was interested in the question of how the Constitution justified anti-slavery politics. And putting the two together, I ended up with this book that I never expected to write about Abraham Lincoln and anti-slavery constitutionalism. As you know, you and I have been discussing this for many years. I like to see Lincoln in context, right? There is an old tradition, Lincoln and his generals, Lincoln and the press, Lincoln and the war governors and things like that, of seeing Lincoln in his context. And there is too much sort of a hagiographic take Lincoln out of his life and times and make him into something larger than life. It's not that he wasn't a great president. He was a great president, but his greatness depended on the moment. And the moment he was in was a crucial moment in the history of the American Constitution, as you yourself have written recently.
Well, since the Constitution does play such an important role in your book, let's quickly remind our audience here of what the Constitution's, at least in the text, the connection to slavery is. On the one hand, you have the sort of pro-slavery Constitution, if one wants to analyze it that way, the Three-Fifths Clause, the Fugitive Slave Clause. Right. You have the anti-slavery Constitution, that the word slavery is never mentioned, the notion of property in man is not mentioned specifically. The question, I guess, is, which is the Constitution something like the Bible that kind of everybody can just appeal to if they want to, or why did Lincoln come to the conclusion that the fundamental impulse of the Constitution is anti-slavery?
Well, this was a tradition he inherited. One of Lincoln's great strengths is that he's a brilliant expositor of anti-slavery political views, but he's also useful because he's completely unoriginal, basically. He doesn't develop any new ideas. He just accepted the premises of the politics he was a part of, and those premises were deeply constitutional. So one of the things I tried to do in the book is show how right from the very beginning, we all know that at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, there was conflict between the supporters and opponents, the defenders and critics of slavery. And the result is a notorious compromise. what I hadn't realized is the degree to which, right from the start, the opponents of slavery recognized the Constitution as, in many ways, a victory for the anti-slavery position. We are so accustomed to taking William Lloyd Garrison's interpretation of the Constitution as a pact with Satan, a pro-slavery atrocity, that I accepted that. And I published articles long ago that accepted that premise. It was just the realization that right from the start, people started citing parts of the Constitution that I hadn't thought too much about as victories for the opposition to slavery. And so, you know, if I ask myself now, does the Constitution empower Congress to ban slavery from the territories? A huge issue. And the answer really is yes. Does the Constitution empower Congress to abolish slavery in Washington, D.C.? And the answer is, I think, plausibly yes. And there are all these issues that become prominent and significant in American politics and lead to the sectional crisis of the Civil War that originate in the Constitution in a way that I hadn't realized. So I traced that out.
One of the things you point out in the book is that there is this sort of what they call the federal consensus.
Yes.
That which is that the federal government can do many things sort of on the periphery of slavery, but it cannot, that Congress has no power to interfere with slavery in the states where it exists. I've always wondered why this was so widely accepted. Lincoln accepted it, as you point out. Yeah. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say this explicitly.
Right.
What is your feeling about how this federal consensus kind of emerged and became so universally accepted?
Well, it seems to have been present at the creation. That is, you see it in the ratifying debates when anti-slavery voices in anti-slavery states like Massachusetts say, look, we can't do anything in the states. I think it is a function of federalism. And Bill Weissick, one of the early scholars of anti-slavery constitutionalism, pointed out to me a while ago that the Constitution leaves all questions of status to the states. So the status of a husband and a wife is state laws determine marriage. State laws create or destroy indentured servitude. State laws are labor laws. And slavery is a status condition that was just presumptively left to the states. So the result is that whatever significance or insignificance you want to attribute to the various clauses of the Constitution that directly relate to slavery, like the Fugitive Slave Clause, like the Three-Fifths Clause, I think they pale in significance to the effect that federalism has on the politics of slavery in the United States.
Federalism, in effect, saying the autonomy in many right. areas of the state governments
exactly.
themselves.
Exactly.
And of course, slavery is created by state law. The federal exactly. government does not create slavery in the
yes.
states, but states can do that. And just about everybody, with one of the few exceptions, acknowledge the power of the states to
yes.
establish slavery if they want
yes.
it.
And that shapes anti-slavery politics and Lincoln's anti-slavery politics in particular. It leads to the, as you know, the end of the book, the last chapter of the book, is he never gives up on the idea that ultimately it has to be done by the states. You know,
right.
even when we're talking about a constitutional amendment, there is a role for the states. It's so.
Right. And of course, he, as this is jumping ahead a little, in his Reconstruction plan, if you want to call it that, or his thoughts about Reconstruction, were based on state governments being created in the South that would abolish slavery.
Yes.
And that was the most direct way to get rid of the institution. You know, as you know, a lot of discussion of Lincoln and slavery ends sort of with the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, right.
Which
right.
It didn't solve the whole problem by any...
No. But
any
it reason. Was crucial. It's
yeah.
hard. It's hard to imagine the process that we end up, that where it ends up, without the Emancipation Proclamation. At least it's hard for me. It's
right.
an absolutely critical turning point in the history of the war and the history of abolition. But
right.
It's not enough.
Lincoln, as you point out, was very devoted to the Constitution and to his particular interpretation of it. his constitutional view kind of helped to create some of what people see as the limits of the Emancipation Proclamation. Is that correct? In other words, it didn't apply to the border states, as you.
Oh yes, 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 and no. That is, as you know, part of the Emancipation Proclamation very definitely applied to the border states. That is, when he opened the Union Army to enlistment of black soldiers, that was not contained by the restriction to the border states. And that, in the year 1863, becomes extremely significant, and significant to the history of abolition, I think, because that's where so many of the unions, of the Black Union soldiers came from. And I think Black Union soldiers play a crucial role in pushing states towards abolition, right, undermining slavery in the states. So yes, the constitutional views prevent him from issuing a proclamation that would cover all the states. It's like, when I talk to my students, it's like, imagine a president announcing that every homeowner in New York State loses his home, right, or her home, right? You can't. It's inconceivable. It has to be done under very specific conditions of domestic insurrection as a war measure, and so you can't do it to loyal states, right?
Right. Could you briefly explain? I know you've written a whole book about this. What exactly is this view of law and constitutionalism that goes under the phrase of freedom national? In other words, there's a, as you know, there's the Garrison and John C. Calhoun and many others said, no, the Constitution is just pro-slavery and the federal government has to protect slavery.
Right.
There were a few abolitionists who said, no, slavery is incompatible with the Constitution and it actually should be just abolished right now.
Exactly.
By courts. They should just declare all the slaves free. Somewhere in the middle there is this freedom national idea.
Right, which I think is the idea that most anti-slavery politicians, and I think probably the majority of abolitionists also accepted. That is, the wherever the Constitution is sovereign, because the Constitution is in on balance an anti-slavery document, that is, it favors freedom and treats slavery as an exception to the rule of freedom. So wherever the Constitution is sovereign, freedom is presupposed. And so much so that by the 1850s, not only does Congress, to anti-slavery folks, say things like Congress can ban slavery from the territories, but that Congress cannot lawfully, constitutionally allow slavery into the territories because the Constitution mandates freedom wherever it is sovereign. That includes Washington, D.C., that includes the high seas, that includes, that has an effect on the way fugitive slaves in the northern states are to be treated by the federal government. So outside of the slave states, the law of slavery does not apply. Freedom is national,
except,
slavery
except,
is merely
there. There is that little sort of exception relating to fugitive slaves.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
They somehow carry the law of slavery into other states.
Yes. And it's very interesting to watch the way pro-slavery people and anti-slavery people interpret the fugitive slave law in very different ways. So that the anti-slavery people, they don't agree, anti-slavery people, about how to restrain the effects of the fugitive slave clause. Some, like Chase, Salmon P. Chase, will say the states alone should be the enforcers of the fugitive slave clause. There's no enforcement clause in the fugitive slave clause, for example. But people coming out of the Whig tradition, like Lincoln, believe that if the Constitution says you have a right to recapture your slaves, it implies a federal enforcement mandate. Then the question is, how do you do that? And they find ways of restricting it. And the crucial issue here, which was new to me, was the centrality of the due process issue in both the fugitive slave issue and the territorial issue, so that it makes more sense of the way secessionists are talking in 1860, that these two issues are on the one hand very different and yet united by the same constitutional theory of who has due process rights once you're outside of a slave state.
Right. as you point out in the book, Lincoln, although he acknowledged that the Constitution required fugitive slaves to be sent back to their owners, if they really were fugitive slaves, he's insisted on procedures so that free people wouldn't get caught up in this, which right. certainly happened frequently.
Right.
But when it came to due process rights within the northern states for let's say free black people, he wasn't particularly didn't say anything about that. Basically,
no.
Illinois, no. as you know, had some very stringent anti-black laws, and I don't remember Lincoln ever challenging those laws.
No.
So, what does he? You know, this gets into the question of the, as you say, federalism to some extent, but. I'm trying to think of how to formulate this question in terms of Lincoln's attitudes. Long ago, my PhD supervisor, as you know, Richard Hofstadter, in a famous essay about Lincoln said, you know, Lincoln argued that that all people, black, white, everyone, were entitled to the basic rights outlined in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And yet in Illinois, he acquiesced at least in measures that would seem to have made it impossible for black people to actually enjoy those rights. So
that's right.
How can we explain that contradiction?
Oh, there are a million explanations. I mean, I mean, you could say he's just go with, you know, Laron Bennett and say that he's just a representative white supremacist, or I suppose, I don't know how you would defend it, because it's not a particularly defensible position, but there are historians who have said that he was sly in the way he avoided directly demanding various forms of racial discrimination. But I think some of it is his just insensitivity to the issue of racial discrimination in a way that strikes us as odd, given his sensitivity to the issue of slavery. We tend to not see those issues as separable. They might be distinct aspects, but they're aspects of the same issue, racial slavery, right? So, but he seemed to separate them, right? Some of it is federalism. Some of it is, you know, you could see him say this in his famous debates with Stephen Douglas. You know, Stephen Douglas is obsessed with things like blacks marrying whites and blacks serving on juries and blacks voting. But those are all issues that are controlled by the state legislatures. So if you're worried about that, send him to the state legislature and send me to the Senate, right? Because the Congress, those aren't issues. Those are not issues that we deal with in the Senate, right? Those are state issues. So he's deferring to racial discrimination by deferring to the prerogatives of states. But that's not enough either, because he made it clear that, you know, a state like Massachusetts may treat blacks relatively equally, but be harsh on immigrants, whereas Illinois was welcoming of immigrants and harsh on blacks. But he said he wouldn't defend the way Massachusetts treated immigrants, but he never said, I won't defend the way Illinois treats black people.
As you know, of course, once you probe into that position, it becomes sort of illogical, in the sense that, as you argue, Lincoln saw these not your basic right to liberty, which he always thought was universal,
right,
but the specific rights that people have within different states, and they varied enormously.
Right,
that was up to the individual states.
Yeah. So can I say a couple of things about that? First, I think I don't want to sound defensive of Lincoln, but to say that all that blacks and whites are equally entitled to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness was a controversial position at the time. So it positioned him in American politics in a very different place from Northern Democrats, and certainly a very different place from Southern Democrats. Also, I think I argue in the book, I don't know if I could prove this, that as he commits himself more and more to anti-slavery politics, beginning in 1854, and begins to elaborate the precepts of anti-slavery constitutionalism, his sensitivity to racial questions grows, right? And he's pushed to the wall in 1858 by Lincoln Douglas and makes some of his most notorious defenses of racial inequality. But almost immediately after that, in 1858, 15, and 59 and 60, you begin to see him do things he never did before, which is explicitly denounce racial demagoguery of the kind that Douglas was fomenting right. all across the North. And I think that during the Civil War, his racial sensitivity grows and grows. Even in that notorious meeting with Black Washington leaders in the summer of 1862, which he suggests that Blacks, they should lead a movement of Blacks to leave the United States. He makes it very clear in that speech that the reason they should leave is because there's nowhere in the United States that Blacks are going to be treated equally, even in the best places, right? So he is aware that the rights he was unwilling to defend in the States diminish the significance of citizenship and the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He's aware of that, certainly by 1862.
Right.
And as you know, by the end of his life, he becomes the first president to publicly endorse Black voting rights for some Black men. So he moves on race in a way
Let's talk a little about his policies during the Civil War, because you kind of argue in an interesting way that the sort of premises of this pre-Civil War anti-slavery constitutionalism one by one get enacted in some way during the Civil War. So the first thing he has to face up to is this question of runaway slaves. They come to be called contrabands. But on the one hand, the Constitution says runaway slaves have to be returned. But what does Lincoln do about this? This is early in the Civil War.
Yes, it is. It's within 6 weeks or so of the beginning of the war. Well, this is one of the points, a larger points I'm trying to make in the book, which is the degree to which mainstream anti-slavery policy, mainstream Republican Party policy was profoundly shaped by radical abolitionist doctrines. And in this case, I call the forfeiture of rights doctrine, which you see abolitionists elaborating in the 1830s, saying that, you know, you do have certain rights under the Constitution to the return of your fugitive slaves. But if you secede from the Union, as you continually threaten to do, you forfeit those rights. Whatever constitutional rights you might have to your slaves, you forfeit by virtue of seceding from the Union. And by the 1850s, you start seeing, you know, the earliest people would be radicals like Horace Mann. But Lincoln is threatening that in 1859. And he repeats the threat in quite explicitly, I think, in his inaugural address, that you complain that you can't get your fugitive slaves back, but what do you think is going to happen when you secede from the Union and your fugitive slaves, now only partially returned, will not be returned at all? That threat is there in the...
Right. Although at first, if I'm not mistaken, he does distinguish between owners who are for the Confederacy and owners... It's a little unclear whether it's slavery, the institution.
Yes, it is unclear.
The loyalty of the owner, that's the issue.
Right. I think that is unclear. I think that is unclear in the policy. I think it's unclear in his statements. But it quickly becomes, I think, impossible to separate the question of whether a slave escaping from Virginia came from a Virginia owner who was loyal to the Union. And so it quickly became any slave escaping from a disloyal state, then a disloyal part of a state like Missouri, and ultimately a disloyal owner from a loyal state, things like that. So loyalty is the key, and disloyalty triggers the forfeiture of rights. And Lincoln, I think, accepts that pretty clearly and pretty early on. You know,
Then the next thing is, again, part of this old Freedom National idea, abolition of slavery in all the territories, right. And then abolition of slavery in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Why do you think Lincoln As you said, one part of the Freedom National, at least among some people, was that slavery really had no right to exist under federal jurisdiction.
Exactly.
And yet the law abolishing slavery in Washington, D.C. in 1862 offers monetary compensation to the owners, loyal owners. If you're disloyal, forget it.
Right.
Why do you think that compensation is in there? It's kind of interesting.
I don't know. I mean, I'd ask you the question. I always suspected that it was guilt money. Like we were responsible for this. In a way, we were not responsible for creating slavery in Georgia. The federal government was responsible for it. And now we're going to take those people away from you as property and give them their freedom. And we're going to have to pay you to do that. You know, but it's the exception that proves the rule. It's the only compensated emancipation that takes place of the 4 million slaves. It was something like, what, it's 1,800 or something?
Well,
like
some would say the Native American emancipation, they were required to give land to the slaves Nation and the Cherokee out in Oklahoma. So they got, so there was a little compensation to the slaves.
To the slaves.
But that's a different
kind of compensation
altogether.
Right.
And then in 1862, as you know, late in 1862, Attorney General Bates issued this ruling that free black people born in the United States were citizens of the United States. This may seem sort of obvious to us, but it was certainly not obvious in 1862.
No, it was a repudiation of the Dred Scott ruling by Justice Taney in 1857. And it also reflected another aspect of the anti-slavery constitutional tradition, which was that once you're free, you can't be made unfree, right? So that if you are a citizen and you become a citizen by the fact that you are emancipated and you were born in the United States and therefore you're a citizen, you can't have your freedom taken away from you. It comes at a critical moment between the preliminary proclamation and the final proclamation. And I think it may have something to do with the fact that the militia law referred only to citizens, that it only allowed it removed the racial distinction for who could join the Union Army, but it didn't remove the citizenship distinction.
Right.
So that's coming up.
But
also the fear pervasive among Republicans and certainly among Lincoln, certainly that Lincoln shared, that you could emancipate the slaves as a war measure, but they could be re-enslaved, theoretically. So the citizenship is part of the effort to create a legal situation in which they can't be re-enslaved.
And then, as you said, just a month or so after that, Lincoln issues the final Emancipation Proclamation, which declares free about 3.25 million slaves.
Right.
It exempts certain parts of the South, the border states, the state of Tennessee.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's the largest single emancipation that we know of in history.
That's right.
But Lincoln, as you said, seemed to always, on the one hand, he famously said, you know, if I go down in history for anything, this is what I will be remembered for.
Right.
And yet he seemed to always worry that it would be somehow declared unconstitutional.
Right.
In fact, in when he talked about Southerners coming back into the Union and taking an oath of loyalty, he said, well, they have taken oath to support the slavery measures unless they're declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court.
That's right.
So
is it not the case that when he died, Taney had a ruling sitting in his desk to declare the Emancipation Proclamation unconstitutional?
Right.
The court would have done that. He had reason to believe that would happen. Right.
Right. So he was very nervous, and that leads directly into what we talked about a little while ago, state by state. One of the important points here is, Lincoln didn't stop with the Emancipation Proclamation and say, okay, we've dealt with slavery.
Right.
He then pursued this state by state
Yes.
One way of putting this is emancipation is not quite the same thing as abolition.
That's right.
Emancipation frees a lot of people, but abolition gets rid of the laws that have created the institution of slavery.
Exactly. Exactly. So in theory, you could emancipate every slave in the state of Georgia, but the state of Maryland is a loyal state, and it's not covered by the Emancipation Proclamation. So when the Civil War ends without a 13th Amendment, the slaveholders, the former slaveholders in Georgia, could go to Maryland and buy slaves, because slavery has not been made illegal. Only the slaves have been emancipated, but not slavery itself.
We're going to, in a few minutes, move over to questions from the audience, but I just wanted to ask one or two further things, and then we'll open it up. You mentioned before that Lincoln was sort of a very mainstream Republican politician and thinker. I think you said he wasn't highly original. He was very good in explaining and expounding these widespread, these ideas that were held by many people. But if it is the case, as you argue, I think very well, that Lincoln's actions as president were in accord with this anti-slavery constitutional position that had developed before the war, why was there so much criticism in the Republican Party of Lincoln for being too slow? In other words, if he was reflecting the mainstream opinion, mm-hmm. how come so much of that mainstream opinion seemed to say, you got to do more and faster?
I don't know. I mean, I can think of all sorts of
reasons. I was wondering, your book made me wonder about that, so I thought I'd get the answer right here.
Well, I do think that why do Republicans right now refuse to repudiate Trump, right?
Good question.
I think that the Republicans coming from electoral districts that were heavily supportive of emancipation and abolition are saying push, 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 you know, and they're saying that in Congress, and they're saying that to Lincoln. But Lincoln was concerned to hold together a coalition that would support the war, even if parts of that coalition did not support emancipation. And he says this quite explicitly in those famous letters in 1863, right? Fine then, just say you'll fight to save the Union if you don't want to fight to free the blacks.
Right.
But remember, they're fighting for you and you're not willing to fight for them. But still, he's acknowledging that a big part of, not big, an important part, maybe an indispensable part of the wartime coalition was people who were not supportive of emancipation and ended up pushing back very heavily against the 13th Amendment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the answer maybe, as you said, is that Lincoln had to speak for the whole North, not just the Republican North.
Exactly.
And sometimes he did both, sometimes he did one or the other, right. but that right. was part of right. leadership. Let me just end with one further question, and that is, the 14th Amendment has been in the news a lot later, but in a way that's rather obscure to accept.
Yes, it was obscure to me.
Yeah, but to what extent, let's deal with the famous part of the 14th Amendment, Section 1.
Okay.
Is that sort of the culmination of this anti-slavery constitutionalism from before
I think
the Civil
so.
War, citizenship, due process?
Yes, I think so. I think so. I mean, it's the first chapter of your recent book. It goes back. There is an older tradition, the Jacobus Tenbrook tradition, that traces the anti-slavery origins of the 14th Amendment, and some other work has been coming out is on the way out that makes a similar claim. And I think it's correct. I think the citizenship issue is one of them. I think the degree to which the rights that the Civil Rights Act protected and that the 14th Amendment protected had come to be viewed, thanks to abolitionists largely, as not just comity-based, not just rights that states recognized, you know, in each other, but fundamental rights that couldn't be taken away. And that, I think, comes pretty clearly out of the abolitionist movement and works its way into the mainstream of the Republican Party and from there into the U.S. Constitution. So I do think that you can't understand any of those Reconstruction amendments without understanding abolitionism and the anti-slavery constitutional tradition that preceded it. It pushes it further, just as the Civil War pushes, accelerates, radicalizes anti-slavery politics, but it comes out of this anti-slavery constitutional tradition, I think.
Okay, well, thank you. And I'm going to turn the floor back over to Tracy now, who will pose some of the questions that have come in to Jim. So take it away, Tracy.
All right. Well, thanks to you both. What a wonderfully insightful conversation this is. And we do have a number of questions stacked up from our audience. So let's see how many we can get through. We will start with this one from Joseph, who says, perhaps mistakenly, I thought the Dred Scott decision allowed a slaveholder to bring a slave as property to any territory, if not another state. However, besides Kansas, was this actually done before 1861? And to what extent was it a threat to existing territorial or state governments?
Well, the Dred Scott decision was a direct threat to territorial governments. It was designed to undermine both the Republican Party's argument that Congress had no power to allow slavery in the territories and to Stephen Douglas's Northern Democratic Party position that local territorial legislatures could keep slavery out. So it was and was designed to be a direct threat to the longstanding right of territorial legislatures to regulate slavery on their own and the right of the federal government to regulate slavery in the territories. I think either one.
Right. Yeah, Jim's book points out that Dred Scott is sort of the opposite, the exact opposite of the position, the constitutional position that Lincoln and other Republicans held. They said the federal government cannot establish slavery in the territories. Dred Scott, Tony said, no, the federal government must protect slavery.
Exactly. It's one of the points I'm trying to make in the book is that by pro-slavery constitutionalism, we're more aware of pro-slavery constitutionalism. We're more aware of William Lloyd Garrison's critique. We're more aware of the Dred Scott decision. But one of the points I try to make in the book is that the pro-slavery constitutional argument develops in dialectical relationship with the anti-slavery argument, that the anti-slavery people push it and the pro-slavery people respond. And by the 1850s, you actually get two fundamentalist interpretations of what rights the Constitution protects in a way that's different from, I think, what the original meaning was back in 1787. That is, the pro-slavery argument as reflected most clearly in the Dred Scott decision, is that the right of property in a slave is so fundamental and guaranteed by the Constitution that the federal government, as Eric said, has an obligation to protect slavery in the territories. It is designed to be the antithesis of anti-slavery constitutionalism. That's why I think people should always read his decision in conjunction with the dissenting positions of McLean and Curtis, because they reflect the alternative position. Even if it's a minority position on the Supreme Court, we are all accustomed to the idea that a majority on the Supreme Court may or may not reflect the views of the majority of the American people.
Question from Carl, who says, I was surprised when I heard Lincoln's entire Cooper Union right makes might speech that it was mainly a legal brief on how each of the founding fathers would be against the expansion of slavery only 70 years after the Constitution was enacted. Are there parallels today when Supreme Court justices are vetted as originalists or not? It seems so hard to make that real over 200 years later.
Wow, I'm not sure I know how to answer that question. I'm not even sure exactly what the question is. Eric and I were discussing just before we went on the air a manuscript I'm reading that does make the case that the original meaning of the 14th Amendment applies today and is much more expansive than than it, the Supreme Court usually understands it to be. So, you know, there are originalist meanings that are restrictive and originalist meanings that are expansive. So we're, in some ways, we're back to square one. You know, your originalism is my outrage.
It's interesting to think that both Dred Scott and Lincoln's Cooper Union speech are exercises in originalism, you might say.
Yes, that's right.
Tawney said, you know, it's not our problem, it's the founding fathers who held that black people have no rights, that a white person is better to respect. That's not my view. We have to go with what the founders. Cooper Union, as the questioner said, Lincoln tries to show that the founders were anti-slavery, that they basically that they were Republicans about 70 years too early.
It's a bit more specific.
What I mean is that the Republican Party is simply following in the footsteps laid down by the founders. People like to go back to invoke the founders on whatever side of an argument they are, adopting.
Right. The specific argument, though, that he was making was that they did not put a constitutional right of property in slaves into the Constitution. And that I think is just true. I think when Tawney says that it's a right of property in slaves is expressly written in the Constitution, that's simply false. You don't have to be a raging originalist or textual absolutist to realize that that's just false. There is no such right in the Constitution. And that's what Lincoln was saying at Cooper Union.
Question for Murray, a question of virtual history. If Justice Taney had ruled differently in the Dred Scott case, what impact would this have had on Lincoln's approach and understanding of the Constitution?
Well, the only plausible alternative decision we can imagine, I take this from Don Fehrenbacher, is a much narrower decision that simply says Dred Scott had no standing and therefore he loses the suit. But instead, we got this expansive, outrageous decision that made all sorts of claims. So if he had left it there, you know, my sense, at least in terms of Lincoln's response, is that it forced him to think not always coherently and not always consistently for the first time about the question of black citizenship. Right? He begins to mull that over publicly about whether or not blacks were or were not members of the political nation at the time the country was founded, whether or not they had the rights of citizenship that Tawney was claiming they did not have. And so it was, it's not so much that a different decision that didn't address that question of, that didn't deny black citizenship might have quieted Lincoln's concerns about the question of black citizenship, which he raises much more explicitly in his inaugural address.
But as Jim said, they could have very easily ruled that there's no case here. Dred Scott is not free, and he has no right to sue in federal court, and therefore, he has no standing, etc. And that's the end of that. But what Dred Scott was claiming, that is that he was free because he had been taken into free territory,
and a free state.
The South definitely wanted that position to be repudiated.
Exactly. That's the essence of the freedom national position that Tawney is determined to overrule. Yes.
Right.
Question from Mark. Lincoln signed the Homestead Act in 1862. In theory, this could have benefited freed slaves. Did a significant number of freed slaves become homesteaders?
Well, you mean by significant? There was a Southern Homestead Act, and Eric is the right person to address that question, not me. I don't know the precise numbers and how you evaluate the significance.
Not a lot, no. But you know, it's interesting. The Homestead Act had no racial qualification in it,
right?
And in fact, it didn't even have a gender one. Women could go out and take up 160 acres of land under the Homestead Act, and some did, but very few blacks did that. As Jim said, there was a Southern Homestead Act later during Reconstruction, but there wasn't very much public land in the South. You know, it was Everglades and stuff like that. So not that many African-Americans got land through either of those two provisions, but most of the former slaves wanted to stay in the South. They didn't want to move out to Kansas or wherever in the Colorado, et cetera. They wanted to land in the South, which most of them, of course, didn't get.
Right. Well, there is a slow accumulation of land on the part of Southern blacks time, and especially ironically, I think, at the turn of the century when the discriminatory Jim Crow laws and disfranchisement are accelerating and the violence is accelerating, there's actually an accelerating accumulation of land on the part of Southern blacks. But it's not like what was necessary to really fully enable the freed people to get launched.
There was a little article in the New York Times either today or yesterday, I can't remember, about the Biden administration's agricultural policy, but it had the tidbit, there are virtually no black farmers left, you know, like 30,000 in the whole country, which is, you know, as Jim said, despite all the evils of the Jim Crow system, many black Southerners were able to acquire small farms. There were hundreds of thousands of them around 1900, but for complicated reasons we can't go into, there's virtually none left.
Carolyn writes, would you look at Lincoln's straddling the fence on segregation as his being a political strategist, meaning he saw that he could not win the segregation argument and still win elections at that time?
It depends on the election. I think you could certainly say that. I think about 1858, about the Senate election in which he is confronted with his remarks about black citizenship, his seeming openness, his claim that the Declaration of Independence was written for whites and blacks. He is directly attacked on that score by Stephen Douglas, and he responds by making his most overt defenses of various forms of racial discrimination. So in the context of an intense political campaign, he does that. He certainly does that. It's harder to say once you're running for president back in those days. I mean, Douglas is different, but you don't say anything. Cooper Union is the end. I mean, he says a few things after that. He goes up to New England, but you know, presidents don't say things, don't talk back. Didn't campaign back then. So it's hard to say whether positions he took on race during the 1860 campaign straddled the issue. I suppose 1864 is interesting because the Republicans were viciously attacked on race-baiting grounds. Well, they were too, you know, in 1860, but 64 and 68 are low points in terms of the use of racial demagoguery in presidential campaigns in American history. And Lincoln doesn't straddle the issue at that point. I mean, I suppose you might, I don't know, you may feel differently, Eric. You know, he comes out relatively late in favor of the 13th Amendment, but he's been pushing in that direction for quite some time anyway, you know? So I suppose that might qualify as straddling, but I don't, you know, it works best as an argument for 1858, I think.
Jim says, and this was briefly addressed in your conversation, but perhaps you can amplify here. Jim says, President Lincoln was the great emancipator, but at one time he supported sending slaves back to Liberia in Africa. I think Professor Foner addressed these changes in thinking in his book, The Fiery Trial. Could both professors comment on this? So perhaps Professor Foner will start with you and then Professor Oakes.
Yeah, well, Jim talks about this also in this new book. It is definitely the case. Lincoln's political idol, as he said, was Henry Clay. Henry Clay was president of the American Colonization Society for a while.
He's Henry one of the Clay, founders of it.
Yeah, Henry Clay thought that the only way to get rid of slavery was to have a gradual plan for abolition and to send or encourage, or in his case, it was more forcefully, to Africa, Central America, something like that. Lincoln embraced this, at least before the Civil War and into the first couple of years of the Civil War. I think the point to be made about it is, as one thing is, as Jim said before, Lincoln was rather pessimistic about the prospects of Black people enjoying the rights they were entitled to in the United States. In this famous meeting in 1862 with a group of Black figures where he encouraged them to promote emigration among their people, he said, you know, you people will never achieve equality here. It's unfortunate. You're entitled to your rights. But in this kind of, in other words, it's a critique of the depths of racism in the United States. But I think Lincoln also felt that until the Civil War, there was no way of getting rid of slavery without some kind of cooperation from slave owners. This, as we said, Congress couldn't abolish slavery. The Southern states would have to take action against slavery. That's what Henry Clay was trying to get Kentucky to do without success.
Right.
And Lincoln felt that the only way to get them to do that was to at least promote this idea that you wouldn't have a giant new free Black population as a result of emancipation. Now, to us and to many people at the time, this was outrageous. Frederick Douglass condemned Lincoln in the most, in the strongest language after that meeting. And absolutely, you know, we are Americans. We have a right to be here. That we, nobody can tell us we have to leave this country. And Lincoln eventually abandoned that. After the Emancipation Proclamation, he never spoke publicly about colonization again. But, you know, there was, it is the fact that there was a period of his life where he, for whatever reason, was identified himself with that policy.
I would only add that that when you say that he knew you needed the cooperation of slaveholders, what that effectively meant is that the states, the Southern states themselves, would have to do it. And he had high hopes, naively high hopes, that this could be done beginning in the border states where slavery was less important and the slaveholders were presumably more moderate, like Henry Clay. And if the federal government, you know, created the right incentives and the nudges and the pressures, then you could use the prospect of colonization as one way of encouraging the slave states to adopt the policy, the same kind of gradual abolition policies that the Northern states had done during and in the aftermath of the American Revolution. So it's part of a larger anti-slavery policy set that he's committed to. But it's also, as Eric said, it's also based on, I think, a profound pessimism about the prospects of racial equality for Blacks in the United States.
So the name Frederick Douglass came up, and Suzanne wants to know, what was the relationship between Frederick Douglass and Lincoln?
Well, I suppose as someone who wrote a book about that, I should answer it. It's interesting. It's an interesting relationship. There were only three meetings of these two men. And there is, I think, you can see in these meetings an evolution over time that towards an increasing respect and even at the end, friendship between them. But, you know, Frederick Douglass had a very important role in American politics, which was, you know, to push further, to be the agitator, to be the spokesperson for a more racially egalitarian, you know, society than America had, and then Lincoln, then a more egalitarian than Lincoln was willing to push. So he was always pushing. He comes to respect what Lincoln did, even as he recognized that what Lincoln didn't do was to some extent driven by the force we mentioned earlier, that his, you know, as a statesman who reflected, was supposed to reflect the views of the larger American public, you know, he was in that context radical, you know, and determined but compared to radicals like Stephen Douglas and Charles Sumner, he was slow and, you know, and unsatisfying in some sense, right?
We've got another question here from Thomas, who says, did anyone in the pre-Civil War era look to the Commerce Clause, as it was later used in the 1950s, to justify the ban of segregation in areas like interstate transportation? For example, did anyone argue that the federal government could prohibit the transport of slaves across state lines?
Yes. The answer to that question is yes. But it gets squashed by the Supreme Court in a famous decision, Groves v. Slaughter, which says that the idea that the federal government, as the regulator of interstate trade, could regulate to death, maybe, the interstate slave trade was something abolitionists talked about in the 1820s and 1830s. But once the Supreme Court ruled that that couldn't be done, that falls out of the anti-slavery project. It's no longer, you no longer see it very much. You do see people continue to say that that doesn't apply to the coastwise slave trade. A substantial number of slaves who were transported on the interstate slave trade from Maryland, Virginia, even South Carolina, to the Southwest, to New Orleans, Texas, and the like, went by boat from the ports. And there were people who continued to argue that the federal government could regulate that, but it never really became part of the anti-slavery project. As we suggested earlier, once the Republicans took control of Congress, they began to implement the anti-slavery project. They abolished slavery in Washington, D.C. They abolished it in the territories. They required abolition as a condition for admission to the Union. They did all the things, but they didn't do the control of the interstate slave trade, in part maybe because the closing down the southern ports effectively closed down the coastwise slave trade anyway. So it was to some extent a moot issue once the Civil War began.
Let's see here. Question from Richard. If Union soldiers were not motivated to end slavery, what was their motivation to take part in the war?
Oh, well, I don't think there is one motivation. People's motivations are all over the place, and some soldiers went in for the fun of the fight. Some soldiers went in just because they were strong Unionists and could also be intense racists, and some went in committed to a war that was all about slavery, and so it varies. I don't think you can say any one thing about individual soldiers' motivations. What I think most historians of Civil War soldiers seem to agree on is that over time, the general feeling among Union soldiers gravitated more and more towards an anti-slavery position, that by 1864, the experience they had in the South, seeing whether it's because they saw slavery firsthand or just because they were the most committed to the Republican administration and the project, became more intensely hostile to slavery and more open to the idea. And once they started fighting side by side with Black troops and saw what Black troops were doing on the field, so they moved, as I think Northern public opinion moved, towards a more accepting view of Black equality based on their increasing hostility to the South and its intransigence, and the record of Blacks during the war. Remember, the issue is always loyalty and disloyalty. And it became very clear, I think, by the end of the first year of the war, that the only reliably loyal people in the South were the slaves. And this is, you see this, Northerners are saying this in editorials, in speeches, they're saying it on the floor of Congress. Blacks are the only reliably loyal Southerners. We have to give up on this fantasy that there's going to be an uprising of white unionists in the South, the only people we can really rely on. And they're getting that from soldiers writing back saying, you know, and generals saying, we got reliable information from the slaves. We need, you know, they're telling us where the Confederates are hiding their arms. They're telling us where the armies are moving, right? They're the only ones welcoming us. When we get to New Orleans, the whites spit at us, but the Blacks welcome us. So these stories are going back, you know, and I think Union soldiers are on the front lines of those experiences, and they move as public opinion moves.
Well, judging from the number of questions in the question box, our audience could talk with the two of you all evening long, but it looks like we've got time for one last question. So we'll go with this question from Stephen, who says, thank you for this great program. Is there any way that slavery, status, citizenship, property rights, et cetera, could have been completely determined and abolition achieved federally rather than stay with the states?
I don't think so, but I don't think so.
Not under the general interpretation of the Constitution, certainly.
Right, right. Yeah. I don't see how. I don't see how. And I don't, and I don't see how even, I don't see how it could have been done without the war.
Yeah, that is the sad fact, I think. I agree with Jim. It's neither of us are bellicose people, but it's very hard. I've never seen a plausible scenario for the peaceful end of slavery in this country, unfortunately.
No. Yeah. No, I said that people who write about the Civil War as a tragedy, I think the tragedy for me, the tragedy of the Civil War was not its pointlessness, but its necessity.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we will end. The book is The Crooked Path to Abolition, Abraham Lincoln and the Anti-Slavery Constitution. Our guests have been Professor James Oakes, the author of that book, and also Professor Eric Foner. Thanks to you both for a wonderfully insightful, fascinating conversation and for sharing your wisdom and your research with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Thanks,
and of
Eric.
Of course, we want to thank Andy and Jason and Laura and all the folks at the Free Library of Philadelphia Author Events team. And of course, special thanks to all of you for taking time in your evening to be with us tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. Please be safe out in the snow. Those of us who are in the Philadelphia area, have a great night and we'll see you next time. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.